Welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. And tonight we have another great guest, one that I've been looking forward to. As I've said to y'all out there before, I sort of read my way out of the church and read a lot of really great books that helped me sort of get my bearings straight. And one of those was Duane Anderson's Farewell to Eden, subtitled Coming to Terms with Mormonism and Science. And tonight, Duane has agreed to join us. Welcome to Mormon Expression, Duane.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me on the show.
Oh, it is my pleasure. And now this book has been out for quite a few years, hasn't it now? Didn't it come out in 2003?
Yeah, I think that's probably about right. I actually haven't looked at the copyright for a while, but yeah, I think it was 2003.
All right. Well, why don't we start out with who you are and how you got to the point of writing this book? So maybe give us a little bit of your background.
Well, I'd be glad to. I was born into the church. My mother and father are both active Mormons, active today. I come from a large Mormon family. I have seven other siblings. There are eight of us all together. And our roots go back quite a bit, quite a ways as well. On my mother's side, I go back to one of my great 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 grandmother was one of Joseph Smith's plural wives. So I've been involved in the church all my life. Was, as I said, born in the church, got baptized. Was a deacon, a teacher, a priest. You know, went through the whole initiation. Became a elder. Went on a mission in the early 70s. Went to British Columbia. And then when I got off my mission, I stuck to the plan, and I went to BYU, and I graduated from BYU with a degree in physics. And while I was at BYU, I found my wife, and we got married. We actually got married when we had 2 years of school left. Each of us had 2 years of school left, and so we finished our last 2 years of school at BYU as a married couple. We both graduated. She has a degree in education, a master's degree in special education. And then after we graduated from BYU, and we were obviously, we were married in the temple, we were married in Manti, we went down to take my first job, which was with an aerospace company in Arizona. And then we lived in Arizona for about 7 years, and then found employment back here in the Northwest. We're both from the Northwest, and so we came back up to Oregon. So that's kind of my background with the church. I was elders quorum president in Arizona. I was also gospel doctrine instructor, and the whole nine yards. I think at one point or another, I was probably in charge of the nursery as well. So I've held just about every kind of position there, outside of a bishopric at the local ward level. And then when we came back up to Oregon, that was where things started to get interesting for me, because up until that point, I'd been what you'd call a true believing Mormon. In fact, you probably would have a difficult time finding somebody that was more energetic in defending the truth or bearing the sword of righteousness, and so to speak, than I was at the time. And when we came up to Oregon, I got really involved, and I thought, I thought to myself, this was, I think, in 85 or so, I thought, or 87, I thought, I'm gonna make this the greatest spiritual year of my life. And so I started doing a very detailed analysis of the Book of Mormon archaeology, or not archaeology, but geology or geography. And I'd read the Book of Mormon many times, probably I think 17 or 18 times cover to cover, and then many times in parts. And so I started trying to make a map of where all these cities and lands were in the Book of Mormon. And that went badly. It just there just wasn't a lot of consistency there. And of course, Mormon apologists have been struggling with that for a long time. But then I also decided, coincidentally with that, I thought, you know, I'm going to read all of the standard works cover to cover. I'd read them all before, but the Old Testament in particular, I just kind of read it as a reading assignment in seminary. And it was when I was reading through the the Old Testament that that some things I really ran up against some big roadblocks. And one in particular was in the book of Numbers, chapter 31. And I don't know how familiar you are with the story there, but, you know, Moses and the Israelites were told to go into the promised land, and they were told to destroy the indigenous people. And Moses and the Israelites didn't quite have the stomach for the level of genocide that Jehovah wanted, so they didn't kill everybody. They just killed the men. They took the women and children as prisoners. And actually, the Israelites did that. Moses didn't. When Moses found out, he was very upset with them. He said, "Look, I told you specifically kill everybody. You disobeyed me. You've kept these women and children as prisoners. Now go finish the job." And when I read that, I thought, "My golly, that's just awful. How could anybody do that?" And then I thought, you know, if I'd been there, and Moses told me to pick up my sword and go start chopping off heads, or however it was they did it, would I have been willing to do that? And you know, I'd like to think that I wouldn't have. So I was very concerned about that. And I made an appointment with the state president. I was very concerned about it, so I talked to the state president, and the state president said, "Well, you know," he said, "God told him to do it, so what's the problem?" it was kind of the first time that it was kind of like the scale started falling from my eyes. Because as I was talking to this guy, I realized that he really didn't have a problem with, genocide. That didn't bother him as long as God was the one commanding the genocide. Basically, as long as you didn't anger the big man upstairs, and as long as he didn't smite you and send you to hell, then there's nothing to worry about. And so that was deeply, deeply concerning to me, and that started me thinking. And you know how a crack propagates in a piece of glass. You know, you get a stress point, and you get a crack that starts to propagate, and then the bigger the crack gets, the faster it goes. And that was really where I thought, well, you know, I'm going to look into this some more. I wrote the general authorities, and of course they didn't reply. They probably knew better. Because this is a really serious problem. You know, it's a very serious moral problem, ethical problem. The first thing I did actually before I even went and talked to my state president was I got the inspired version out, because my first thought was, well, certainly Joseph Smith fixed that. And but you know, he didn't. He thought, apparently in his great wisdom and inspiration, genocide is also okay with Joseph Smith as long as you don't anger God and you have God's permission, have at it. So I kind of pursued this. I ran the course with that question through the church authorities and so forth. And at the time, I was the elders' quorum president. And finally, I told my wife, I said, you know, I just I can't believe in a church that would condone genocide. And it doesn't matter to me whether they're condoning the act of genocide this year, last week, or 2,000 years ago. I mean, there has to be a constant in our moral values, and it just doesn't have room for genocide. So I went in and I talked to the stake president, and I was released. I said, you know, I can't be elders quorum president anymore. I don't believe in the church. And I said, I'd like to be released. So I was released at my request. And then I continued to kind of straddle the fence for a period of time. But I started reading other stuff. You know, at this point in my life, I decided, you know, I'm gonna look into the church a little more carefully. One of the first two books that I read was I got a hold of a book called The Mormon Murders, which is about Hoffman and his dealings with the church. And then I also read Fawn Brody's book, No Man Knows My History. And by the time I finished reading those two books, roughly a year had gone by. And I had pretty much at that point concluded, well, Mormonism can't possibly be true, and I'm not going to be actively involved in it anymore. So I had, you know, some pretty long and oftentimes emotional conversations with my family, my wife about this. She was a very faithful member of the church, you know, it's pretty frightening for a Mormon to have their spouse tell them they don't believe in the church anymore. So, but at any rate, one of the first things I did is I said, well, I'm not giving them any more of my money. they got the last dime of it. And in fact, I had paid. Even after I had been released as Elders Quorum President, I had continued to pay my tithing for about a year. And towards the end of that year, I held back two of those checks because it was just getting harder and harder to give them to the church, because I was really coming to the conclusion that I'd been the victim of fraud. And so finally I said, you know, they're not getting these last two checks. So I went out and I bought a good mountaineering tent because I'm an avid mountain climber. I bought a really nice mountaineering tent, a really good pair of Danner climbing boots, and I still have them, actually. I just got the Danner boots resold. So that was the last they got from me out of that. But at any rate, you know, one of the agreements I made with my wife was that I wouldn't try and talk our kids out of the church. I'm not sure how well I kept that agreement. I don't think I ever actually sat down with them and said, I want you to stop going to church. In fact, I continued to go to church with my wife every Sunday until I think it was about 2004 or 2005.
Wow.
So yeah, I went to church as a non-tithe paying, non-believing critic of the church for 10 or 11 years.
So I guess you never received any sort of real negative feedback from the church for the book, like any sort of disciplinary action then?
No, and you know, that frankly, I was disappointed. I thought I'd written a better book than that. I thought I'd written one that would get me excommunicated. But they didn't do that. And I, like I said, I don't think I tried to talk my kids out of the church, but once that goofy grin goes off your face, it's pretty clear to people that you don't believe in the church anymore, and my kids knew that. They, you know, I wasn't confirming them in the priesthood. I wasn't doing all those kinds of things. You know, the church is institutionally organized in a way to marginalize inactive or non-member fathers.
Right.
And it makes it very hard for a non-Mormon father or an inactive father to be very actively involved with the kids, or at least to maintain his dignity, because while everybody else's kid is doing it for their kid, the non-Mormon or inactive father, he's sitting on the sidelines. But interestingly, none of my kids are active, and I've talked to them since then, and I said, when did you realize the church wasn't true? And they all said they figured it out before their teens. So,
well, the church itself teaches its members that if you don't constantly, put energy in and propagandize and keep them from the media and don't let them talk to people and don't believe in science, then they will fall away. So I think keeping kids in the church is a much higher maintenance task than a lot of members realize.
Oh, yeah, it's really hard. And the key there is that testimonies have to be nourished. You've heard that before, right?
Right.
Testimonies have to be nourished, and the reason a testimony has to be nourished is because it's such a bunch of baloney. I've never had to nourish a testimony about the law of gravity, or I've never had to nourish a testimony about the laws of quantum physics. I've never felt the need or urge to bear my testimony that gravity is true. In fact, when you think of it along those lines, it's just pretty absurd. You don't bear your testimony about things that you know are true. You bear your testimony about things that you know are not true, but you really wish they were.
Well, and in a related note, you don't have with things that are more likely to be true. Those things, you don't have to keep going back and repeating the fundamentals over and over and over again. For example, when you learn the law of gravity in your first year of physics, that keeps getting confirmed over and over and over again with each advancing year. You don't have to keep teaching that same principle again and again because it slips away. So I think there's another confirming, for things you want to take as truth, they tend to become self-evidently so even as you challenge and go on to more advanced materials.
Exactly. In fact, imagine somebody in their in a graduate class in physics saying, "Professor, would you reaffirm the truth of the law of gravity for me?" He'd look at you like you had bats in your head, and it really is true. I mean, I think it's oftentimes in order to see the absurdity of some of these things, you just need to change some of the words and see how silly they sound when you put regular secular type of scientific words in place of words for testimony and so forth. So anyway, eventually I got to the point where I got so frustrated over the difficulty of having left the church and some of the things that I heard coming out of the apologetic community that I thought, these guys really, the apologetic community is trying to invalidate the reasons that I had for leaving the church and the reasons that a lot of other people had for leaving the church. And that's not fair. Anybody that's left the church knows how excruciating and painful it is. And they know how much soul searching goes on, and they know how much praying goes on, and they know how difficult it is, and they know how much angst it causes all their family members and so forth. And for me to go through that experience and make the personal sacrifice of leaving the church and then have some dummy at fair get up and say the church has no opinion on evolution, I just thought, I'm not just going to let this go unanswered.
Right.
So even though I dedicated the book to my Uncle Marlowe, I probably should have dedicated it to the guys at Fair and Farms, because they were the real true inspiration behind writing the book.
Well, let's talk a little bit about science and religion. I mean, that's sort of the theme of the book. You know, sure. Recently in the last year or so, Daniel Peterson and some of those guys have started a website called Mormon Scholars Testify. I don't know if you've ever had the privilege of walking through its pages. But
I visited it, yeah.
The gist of the website is there's a lot of Mormon scientists or scholars or engineers or whatever who give their testimony. I haven't read through all of them, but I've read through a great deal of them. And generally speaking, their testimony is in spite of their scholarly learning rather than confirmed by their scholarly learning, but that's sort of a side issue. So there's all these scientists out there who say, hey, you know, science and Mormonism are compatible. So what's your response to that apologetic sort of assertion there?
Well, believe it or not, I've actually put my response out on a similar site called Ex-Mormon Scholars Testify. Have you seen that one?
Yeah, they asked me to put mine up, but I told them I was neither a scholar nor an ex-Mormon, so I didn't really qualify.
Okay, well, there's a site called Ex-Mormon Scholars Testify, and I actually I put my scholarly testimony up there. I shouldn't call it a testimony. In fact, I point that out in my article. But it's as I said. That first of all, if you've got a scientist testifying about something, he's not testifying about science, because science doesn't need testimony. Science works with facts and evidence and data, right? So whoever it is out there that thinks they're a scholar and they think they're testifying about Mormonism, well, they're not testifying about Mormonism as a scholar. They're testifying about Mormonism as somebody with a superstitious belief. And, you know, there's nothing that says you can't do science on Monday and be superstitious as a clown on Sunday. And in fact, you know, even guys like Newton were caught up in certain elements of superstition. Superstition is a birthright of humans. I think it's probably has evolutionary origin. And there's several guys that have talked about that. Dawkins, I think, has put forth some really good evolutionary explanations for where superstition arises.
And you know, it's not just superstition. You know, we still as humans love that the fallacy of authority, and you know, there's all sorts of scholars who are expert in one avenue who've said all sorts of bonehead things in another realm of science. I mean, just because you know a lot or you're very intelligent in a particular realm doesn't mean you have diddly squat to say about other things. I'm thinking of Watson from Crick and Watson fame, and he said a lot of crazy things outside of his realm of expertise. So, yeah, you know, Newton was an alchemist, and it goes on and on. So I want to make clear that I'm not saying that the people on Mormon Scholars Testify are unintelligent. It's just they're not applying the pattern of science to their faith.
That's exactly true. And you brought up an interesting point with regard to authority. One of the arguments that Dawkins makes is that religion is an expression of authority, and that belief in authority is actually very important to us as a species. And then Dawkins goes on to give the example. He says, when a child is growing up, one of the survival advantages that they have is the ability to accept the authority of their elders and to learn from their elders. And you can imagine in a primitive society that could be very important. You'd have to be able to trust your elders and believe your elders when they said, don't eat this plant root and watch out for that big animal over there. This is how we pass on knowledge and culture. So it's kind of built into us from an evolutionary point of view that we do trust people. We need to do that. And the problem is that trust can then later on in life, it can get us in trouble. Sometimes we trust a guy because he's wearing a suit and you can see his temple garments and he's selling bogus investments to us. So that trust can go both ways. So I agree that I think that the whole element of authority is very important there, and I've been known to characterize Mormonism as an authority cult. I don't know of any other religion where authority is so important, and maybe that plays into some of this whole testimony thing. But the other point I wanted to make with regard to science and religion is that the Mormonism, and not just Mormonism, but any religion that is like Mormonism and science, they diverge right from the very beginning. Because in science, what you do is you basically say, I follow the evidence. I will formulate hypotheses, I will test them against the evidence, and if the evidence doesn't support the hypotheses, then I will throw the hypotheses away. And in Mormonism, you do exactly the opposite. You say, this is what I believe in. I believe the church is true, that Joseph Smith was a prophet. I will now examine the evidence, and if the evidence doesn't support my belief in Joseph Smith, I will throw the evidence away. So the divergence is right from the very beginning. The two systems of thought are incongruent from the very start. It's not just the facts that they present, or the presumed facts that they present, that are out of kilter. It's the whole understructure and philosophy of thought that is completely incongruent between the two.
Yeah, definitely. If you start from any conclusion and argue backwards, you can prove it, because you'll just disregard any evidence to the contrary.
Sure. I call that the belief diode. So if you have, it's like, you know, if the evidence supports you, you keep it. If it doesn't, you throw it away, and pretty soon you've got a bucket full of evidence that you think supports the idea that Joseph Smith was a prophet.
Yeah, and I think one of the telltale signs of that is when you have pseudoscience and religion where they're arguing from a rational perspective, there will be contradictory evidence that they use to support their conclusion. Because as long as it supports the conclusion, it's good.
That's exactly right. And oftentimes I'm amazed at how often, if you disagree, if you point out an error in handling evidence, you're branded as an anti-Mormon.
Yes, definitely.
And a good example is the DNA evidence. Okay, the DNA evidence that tells us where the ancient American ancestors came from is very solid, very sound, and very non-controversial. These people came from areas in and around Siberia about 12,000 years ago. But if you were to stand up and say that in church, you'd be an anti-Mormon.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that is you don't even have to get into the DNA. There are physical characteristics and traits that Native Americans and those across Siberia share, you know, like the back spot that goes away.
Right.
You don't have to, like, look at their blood to find that they are of a related genetic group.
Right. And it's also archaeological and it's linguistic. But, you know, one of the most interesting things that I find is that their dogs, the DNA of their dogs traces back through Siberia.
Yeah.
So,
if you look at it with an unbiased perspective, if you're not LDS in this particular thing, it's just one of those things that's so well-founded that you wouldn't question it unless you had a religious dogmatic reason to do so.
Right. And then, of course, I think the church is probably starting to realize that. You know, I mean, they change, but they change slowly, and they go kicking and screaming all the way. But, you know, they're gradually trying to do a little foot dance here and backpedal as they took out, I think, out of the Book of Mormon, they took out the phrase that it's about the principal ancestors,
right,
of the ancient Americans. You know, they're they're gradually trying to back out of this corner, and I can imagine that there are conversations between the general authorities and some key apologists where the apologists are saying, look, you better start fixing this problem now.
Yeah, it makes you wonder who's driving the bus these days, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a correlation committee.
So if we talk about evidence and, you know, objective evidence and, you know, validating a conclusion, so what would be sufficient evidence to conclude the church is true?
Well, to conclude the church is true, or to conclude the Book of Mormon is true, or you mean the whole church?
Well, let's give them whatever one is easiest to...
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a phrase, I think, that Mormons like to toss around to the effect of, oh, you wouldn't believe in the Book of Mormon even if they uncovered a sign that said next exit to their Hamlet or something
right.
to that effect. Have you ever heard that one?
Yep, I've heard that.
Yeah, I've heard that one. Well, actually, you know, I've posted many times on the internet that I'd be very happy to accept the Book of Mormon is true if certain evidence was presented for it. So, for example, if there was an authentic book, and by authentic book, I mean one that's found by actual archaeologists and described and reported on in the peer-reviewed journals, science journals, if there was an authentic book that of ancient American origins that was written in Hebrew or Egyptian or a derivative of those languages, and if it described exactly the same events and people and places and so forth that we read in the Book of Mormon, then, you know, if that was to happen, then I think you'd have to say, you know, that just couldn't have happened by accident. And so the Book of Mormon must be true. And I would probably, I'd probably say that would convince me. In fact, I would say it would convince me that the Book of Mormon is true. Now, will that ever happen? I doubt very much it will ever happen. And I think most Mormons doubt very much that it will ever happen. But even if the Book of Mormon is true, you know, that doesn't mean the LDS Church is true. the Book of Mormon, if the Book of Mormon is true, then you'd have to conclude that Joseph Smith was getting some accurate information from a non-traditional source. But it's possible that he could have got that information from space aliens. It's possible he could have got it from Jehovah. Who knows where he got it from? So in order to make the leap from the Book of Mormon to the LDS Church, I guess you'd have to say, first of all, whether or not you believed that Joseph Smith was right about everything else he did. But let's assume that we can do that. Let's assume we take that leap of faith and we say, okay, the Book of Mormon's true, so Joseph Smith was right about everything else he said. There's still a huge gulf between Joseph Smith and the LDS Church because the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints no longer practices or teaches what Joseph Smith did. The church that Joseph Smith organized is very different from the church in Salt Lake City today. In fact, I think if Joseph Smith was to be reincarnated and try and be active in the church today, they'd excommunicate him right away.
That's true.
You know, I mean, just in my short lifetime of the last 50 so plus years, I've seen just dozens of the common teachings that Joseph Smith taught fall by the wayside. I can recall, you know, when my wife and I, and by the way, we're still married. It's been 34 years, coming up on 34 years.
Wow, congratulations.
So, yeah, we got 5 kids, 2 grandkids, and so it worked out. That's a very unusual thing. Most of the time, marriages like ours would break up.
It's tough.
Under the pressure from the church. But at any rate, you know, I can remember when we got married, we we openly discussed how many wives I was going to have. Well, the expectation was that eventually the church was going to start practicing polygamy again, and, you know, I'd have more than one wife. I can remember as a young boy being terribly despondent when I found out that after the millennium, the world was going to be reformed into a giant Urim and Thummim, and all the mountains were going to be gone. Because I love to climb mountains. Well, you know, if you talk to people now in the church about Joseph Smith's teaching that the earth would be reformed into a giant Urim and Thummim, they'll look at you like you don't know what you're talking about. But, you know, I can remember when the 70s had their doctrine. In fact, I've got the copies of the 70s doctrinal books. I mean, there's just such a rich, deep theology that Joseph Smith invented, none of which is in the LDS Church. So I would have to conclude, quite frankly, if the Book of Mormon is true and Joseph Smith was a prophet, I would have to conclude that the LDS Church is an apostate offshoot. And I'd go look maybe at one of the fundamentalist organizations to see if that's where the truth was.
All right, so we talked about DNA a little bit. You know, from a scientific bent, what do you think are the most problematic areas for the Mormon faith?
Oh, wow. Well, certainly, you know, if you're going to look at what the church has taught, you know, when you say problematic areas, you have to say, well, you mean problematic according to what they teach now or problematic according to what they taught 50 years ago?
Well, you know, that's true, but I think there are still some that they can't divorce themselves from. For example, I think the church can distance itself from the Noahic flood. You know, they can say it was a local flood or local event, because not really anything that hangs on that. But they can't really distance themselves very well from the Tower of Babel, because the Book of Mormon hangs on that, and the myth of the changing of the languages. So it's true,
right?
There are some scientific things, you know, like and probably in between those two is something like evolution, where there's definitely been prophets and doctrines that contradict evolution, but it doesn't always cause tons of problems. Now, death before the fall, I think, causes the church a lot of problems. So anyway, there's my shotgun approach.
Yeah, I mean, when I was growing up, I was definitely taught that there was no death before the fall. And that obviously is a problem. The Doctrine and Covenants says the earth has had a temporal existence of 7,000 years.
Yep.
The last time I read the Doctrine and Covenants, it gave a genealogy back to Adam. And the whole idea of Adam is completely at odds with science. There was no first man. Or first woman, for that matter.
Right.
And you know, when I hear these guys at BYU saying that evolution is consistent with Mormonism, I just have to say, you know, what have you guys been smoking? They're either being dishonest about the science or they're dishonest about the scriptures, because there is no room in evolution for an Adam and an Eve. There is no room in evolution for a specially created human, for that matter.
Yeah, they're pretty quick to dismiss Joseph Fielding Smith and his writings. And I think Joseph Fielding is a lot smarter than modern apologists give him credit for and understood Mormon theology. You know, of course, he wrote Man, His Origin and Destiny and other works in which he flatly condemned evolution. And I cannot see a reasonable merging of the two. I think you can't have Mormonism without the fall and everything that comes with it.
Well, I mean, you know, I've been to the temple, you know, hundreds of times, and the last time I was in the temple, they were talking about Adam and Eve. And I've read, you know, all the scriptures, and the last time I read the Pearl of Great Price was talking about Adam and Eve. I don't see how anybody can say that Mormonism doesn't teach that there was a literal man named Adam and a literal woman named Eve, and that they were the parents of the entire human race. But that's completely out of line with evolution. You can't have that in evolution. So that's a big problem. Of course, the Book of Mormon, the keystone of Mormonism, is probably the weakest link. There's not very many religions that are so perfectly positioned to be knocked over by science as Mormonism is, and because of the Book of Mormon. Next in line would be the Book of Abraham. You know, the Book of Mormon, the Mormon Church does seem to be just uniquely positioned to be falsified. So anyway, those are obviously the big ones. I think the flood, there have been conference reports that state unambiguously that Mormons believe in a universal flood. And I think when you have something that's said at conference, it's pretty hard to just dismiss it and say that's not doctrinal, because especially when you consider all of the approval cycles that things go through before they're said in conference.
Yeah, and I think there's a problem the church has to deal with, which is many Mormons are uniquely unprepared to engage the world, which is kind of ironic given the number of missionaries they send out each year. But, you know, they encourage the kids to go to institute and seminary and get all their stuff from Sunday school, where they have lesson manuals that teach these sort of myths like the flood, without even addressing the counter evidence at all. And I think it leads to people, you know, walking away from the church when they painfully run into the brick wall of what the rest of the world knows and they're not unaware of.
Yeah. Yeah, that may be true. The process of leaving the church is an odd one. The church has made it so you cannot extract yourself from the church without almost always losing your family.
That's true.
And I think they've done that deliberately. It's certainly an institutional program that they have, and from my point of view, the church holds families hostage, and that's one of the reasons, by the way, I don't think they're very family friendly, because if you love something, you don't hold it hostage. But I personally know a number of people in the church that flat out don't believe the church is true at all, but they stay very active in the church because they are afraid of losing their family.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm convinced of the same, that the number of people who have problems with it. Well, test my words. Go to any sacrament meeting, and turn around and look and see what people are doing. They're playing with their Blackberries and they're messing with this and messing with that. And that I don't think it's as spiritually satisfying as a lot of people believe, but that, like you said, the cost of leaving is so high in terms of employment and relationships and marriages and children and all of that.
Exactly. And that was one I didn't hit on, was employment. But certainly if you're in Utah, you've got a lot more to lose than somebody who's up here in Oregon. You know, if you're in Utah, your neighbors are Mormons, everybody around you is a Mormon, and your employer is probably a Mormon too.
Well, and I would say it extends beyond just the Utah corridor, because if you have some marker like a BYU degree, I've been through this situation interviewing for jobs across the country where you interview with somebody who's asking about BYU, you don't know if they're pro or con. And you don't know if even some well-placed executive, and, you know, BYU's turning out a lot of MBAs and that sort of thing, can find out. So I don't think just moving out of Utah solves that problem.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, for somebody like me, it's almost impossible to hide, because they would Google me and I'm pretty prominent. But even if you're, you know, all it takes is just a question or two, like, and they'll be subtle about this. They'll say, well, you know, where'd you go on your mission? And kind of look at your shirt collar, things like that.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And it's tough, you know, because as a ex-Mormon or a former Mormon, you can get the prejudice both ways. You can be discriminated against both for being a Mormon and for not being a Mormon.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Okay, in terms of in terms of where the faith is going today, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, the things of Joseph Smith's time. How do you think the gulf is, do you think it's getting worse? You know, we look at things like archaeology, we look at things like biology, or do you think the church is able to insulate itself more from these things?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. There was a survey that was done, I think, by the Pew Institute a couple of years ago on different religions and how they viewed evolution. And the LDS Church and the Jehovah's Witnesses essentially tied for being the most antagonistic towards evolution. And that, frankly, that kind of surprised me. I would have thought that the LDS Church had improved in that area, and they've actually, I think they've actually gotten a little bit more rigid in that area. So my thinking is that the apologists are certainly getting more vocal, but I think the rank and file have actually dumbed down a little bit.
Yeah, I've noticed the same thing, and of course we're not the first to point this out, that the apologists seem to be going more extreme, you know, in their painting of a limited geography for the Book of Mormon, or their marriage of, say, evolution and the theology, or you know, the isolation, saying, oh, the prophet in that instance was speaking as a man, where they're, to me, they're diverging more and more from what the common members believe. And if you dropped yourself in any ward and sort of on the sly gave a poll, you know, I think you'd find that most Mormons dismiss evolution. They believe in the Noahic flood. They believe the 7,000-year history of the church, and all those fundamentalist positions are still front and center for the majority of the members. And beyond that, I think a lot of them are incredibly naive about what issues are problematic for the church.
Yeah, I think that's true. I know it was for my kids. I've talked to my kids and I've asked them, you know, what kind of stuff they learned in seminary and Sunday school, and they all said very, very bluntly that you know, the church was absolutely against evolution. And I, you know, the other thing is that my kids, at least in growing up in the church, they didn't know anything about what the apologists were saying. I think, to a large extent, the apologists are just preaching to each other. I don't think the members of the church really know. Maybe one service that Fair and Farms provide is that you can say, oh, Fair and Farms wrote an article on that, so it's all taken care of, and then without even reading it or bothering to look into it further, the member will just waddle off and think that it's all taken care of.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. That that, and you know, I've heard it said, I can't even remember where, that the brethren have said to the apologists, basically, you have our flank. And what they mean by that is that there are these intelligent members who know that Fair and Farms are out there and can read the review, and it sounds pseudoscientific, it sounds scholarly. And not to say those guys aren't intelligent. In my opinion, they're just applying their intelligence in the wrong way. So they say, oh, yeah. Here's an example of what I'm talking about. Let's talk about Nibley. Most people can't understand what Nibley's talking about. I mean, he's pulling sources from 100 different places and talking about Sumerian mixed with Hittite and blah, 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 blah. And they say, wow, he seems so intelligent. If it's okay with him, it's okay with me.
Right, exactly. But you know that I will say that I have had conversations with folks that teach at BYU and that have taught at BYU, professors there. And it's very clear from my conversations with them that they don't believe in the church either, and they don't believe all the garbledygook that Fair and Farms are putting out, but for them, they're really caught in a bind.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because their livelihoods, not just their families, but their retirements, their livelihoods, everything is tied up. The church has just got them tied and wrapped up in such a nice tight knot that they can't possibly get out of it. And I also know from talking to some of these guys that a lot of the stuff that's put out by BYU professors through FAIR and through FARMS is actually assignments. Those are assignments. So these guys are told, you will write an article on this and you will refute this idea for us and so forth. So they're not necessarily, these guys are not necessarily willing participants.
Yeah, and I want to underline what you just said. I want to give a concrete example so people know what we're talking about. The church does not pay into unemployment insurance. So normally, if you get laid off or let go, you know, you can collect money from the government because it's an insurance thing. It's an insurance policy. And that will help tide you over till you get the next job. The church opted out of that system. So if you end up leaving, or you get let go for lack of faith, you're immediately without income. So,
right.
So you know, the church does things like that to cut that safety net out from underneath those guys. So the cost of leaving is so high, which is just metaphoric of what we've been talking about across the board.
Right. And you know, frankly, if I had to pay that price, I wouldn't have paid it.
Yeah, I don't think I would have either.
Yeah, if it would have cost me my family and my job, I would have just said, you know, fine, I'll just keep paying my tithing and going to church and I'll just keep it all under my belt.
You know, one question I was thinking about asking during this interview, but is, well, suppose you're a member who's questioning where do you go to find out about, you know, science and reason and the history and I'm going to correct myself because it's really a stupid question to ask. You can go just about anywhere else. I mean, outside the church. And to me, you'll find enough evidence. You can go, in my opinion, to any department in a university, be it the biological department, the historical department, the archaeological department, whatever, and you will find contradictory pieces of you know, well-established theory that will be in direct in direct contradiction to what the church says every week in Sunday school.
Yeah, that's true. I have said in the past that any reasonably intelligent person, if they were given an hour in a reasonably well-equipped library, would be able to figure out the Mormon Church is not true. This is not a great leap of intellect by any means at all. Figuring out that the Mormon Church is false is something any dummy can do. It has a lot more to do with personal constitution and personal commitment, and at the end of the day, probably a lot to do with personal circumstances too, as we just talked about. Some circumstances are much harder to walk away from than others.
Yeah, and once again, to repeat, I don't think it has anything to do with intelligence. It has to do with those propositions the church has you arrive at from the birth, from when you first start going to the sunbeams. You know, they're going to drive these fundamental things in that, you know, the church is true, the Joseph Smith is a prophet, the current prophet is a prophet of God, and those above everything else. So it's not that the members of the church are moronic, it's just that once you accept those things, you're looking through a lens darkly on everything else.
Exactly. Yeah, in fact, I would say that most of the Mormons that I know are probably pretty average intelligence. I mean, I think they represent a fairly average, sampling of Americans in terms of their intelligence. But clearly, and you know, it's not just the Mormons. I mean, it's about how you handle evidence. And I would go so far as to say that the temptation to mishandle evidence doesn't stop when you stop being a Mormon either.
No, I mean,
it really is part of our heritage, is our evolutionary heritage.
Well, and if there's anything I'm thankful for in, you know, my faith crisis and my losing my faith in Mormonism, is that it really taught me critical thinking skills and sort of how to look at things and address the world. And hopefully I'm better in my other realms of thinking because of what I had to do.
Yeah, I think it does help you. I mean, the ability to to think critically enough to evaluate a religion that you've practiced your whole life, that's a powerful tool. That's a very good skill.
Yeah, definitely. So, Duane, the book was Farewell to Eden. It's still in print, I believe. You can go into Amazon or your favorite bookstore and get a copy of it.
Yeah, you can order it through bookstores, or you can order it through Amazon.com.
And maybe if enough people go out there and buy it, we can get Duane excommunicated after all.
Well, actually, in 2005, I finally had enough of it. And in fact, the thing that finally pushed me over the edge was when I saw Gordon B. Hinckley hugging Cheney or Bush or somebody. And I decided, you know, it's a silly religion. It's inconsistent with science, but now it's turning into kind of this weird right-wing organization, and I just really don't want anything more to do with it.
Wow, that was before Glenn Beck ascended to power, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, if Hinckley hadn't done it, Glenn Beck would have. But I actually wrote my letter of resignation, so I'm officially not a Mormon anymore.
Well, all right. Well, thanks for coming on. It's been really fun talking to you.
And likewise, thank you for talking to me.
All right. Well, as always, the discussion continues on the website at MormonExpression.com.